Whoever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you are catching some brainwaves. Coming to you from the banks of the immaculate, the untarnished St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado, I'm Ben Kalb, and across the table is the only co-host who has never failed to keep a New Year's resolution. She's Becky Peters. Becky, what's good?
It's all good, Ben. I'm crazy lucky that for most of 2018, we've had the pleasure of bringing Giants in Education to the earbuds of my favorite people, busy teachers, to help us be more informed, inspired, and connected educators. I really can't believe it's already the end of the year. This has been one of the fastest years of my life.
Yeah, it definitely has been very fast, and it reminds me of a saying that my dad always says. He said, life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes. So hopefully it slows down for all of us just a little bit.
That's probably not going to slow down. But as teachers, we know that looking back and processing our learning is so crucial. And we wanted to do that for this podcast, to look back at each of our favorite moments from the 2018 interviews on Brainwaves and to use some of those to realign our goals.
Yeah, and we've been so over our skis with the guests that we've had and people we really have no business talking to that it is hard to narrow it down to some of our top moments, but some of my favorite podcasts are best of podcasts, and so we're going to try that for you, the audience. We are going to select our top five moments from this first year of Brainwaves from 2018.
Here is number five.
And my top five moment number five, coincidentally, comes from episode five with Pirate Dave, Teach Like a Pirate's Dave Burgess, when he said,
mediocrity doesn't motivate. Nobody, lukewarm sucks. Like, you don't want to, who wants something that's lukewarm? Who wants something that's mediocre? Who gets up in the morning saying like, man, I can't wait to get in my classroom and be lukewarm today. I'm like halfway excited about my lessons today. That's this kind of it. Don't expect anyone to be enthusiastic and passionate about something that you're not. And so like a teacher will come to me and say like, oh, I don't understand what's happening. Kids just don't seem to be excited to be in my room. I'm like, yeah, I can't understand why.
That's amazing.
You're just a fireball of energy. Just so my goal is different, right? Like when I step in front of kids, like I have a goal. I'm gonna turn on the propane. I'm gonna douse myself with the gasoline of enthusiasm and spark it with the flames of inspiration. I'm gonna light up when I get in front of kids, right? And so.
When you talk like that, it kind of makes me think of that quote on your website. If they didn't have to be in your room, would you be teaching to an empty room? Yep. I get kind of nervous about asking teachers that because it almost feels kind of rude. But I think that's true. If they didn't have to be here, who would be in your room right now? And I would be in your room, Dave. I got to tell you that.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's it. That's the essential question of Teach Like a Pirate. They didn't have to be there. Would you be teaching to an empty room? That's the essential question of the entire book. And like, so what is it about you? Is there something about you and the way you make kids feel and the kind of experiences you create for them in your room that they would be drawn and they would be there anyway?
Wow, that was awesome.
So I just love this moment because I want to bring the energy that Dave does to every professional learning I do. I want my classroom to be so magnetic that it draws people in, even if they don't have to be there. So I definitely loved episode five with Pirate Dave and thank him for reminding me to bring passion behind everything I do. Becky, what you got for number five?
What you just said kind of reminds me of episode 11 too, when the math guru Dan Meyer said,
never assume that anyone even cares, which I love the phrasing. I love the even in that, like never assume anyone even cares. What I want to do is rid myself of a lot of the usual incentives that I think students should or do have around mathematics, which include an interest in pleasing me. I do not want to assume that that's the case. An interest in getting a grade, even an interest in mathematics itself. It's like I have the power of the state behind me to say, like, you need to pass math class. Math teachers have this particular gift that, say, visual and performing art teachers may not, or elective courses don't, where, like, I can just, like, I can teach however I want, really, and you have to pass my class in order to graduate and succeed in life. Like, oftentimes, a corollary to Baxter's maxim there is teach math as though it were an elective. If you taught math as an elective, how would that change the way you taught? If you had to really hustle for enrollment every year or you would lose your job.
And again, like you said, that's, we need to bring passion and energy to everything we do. But I learned this year that my ability to bring more energy to certain situations isn't really by happenstance, but that my abilities to do so can fluctuate throughout the day. So my fifth top moment harkens back to episode 9 when the Daniel Pink said,
time and timing plays a much bigger role in our lives than most of us realize. It operates mostly in visibly, but at a very deep, deep, deep meta level, you know, we human beings are temporal creatures. We've all heard about a biological clock. We essentially have biological clocks in every cell in our body. And we also live in a temporal environment. I mean, it's weird, but this conversation, Ben and Becky, we started it in the past and we'll finish it in the future. That's like freaky, right? And so so time and timing is omnipresent, and that's why it matters so much. And then when you look at some of the research on timing, which I did for this book, when you realize that timing has an enormous role in our performance in any kind of job, including teachers, it has an effect on how students perform. And it's something that we need to take more seriously than we previously have. In Denmark, students take standardized tests as they do here in the States, but they take the tests on computers. And the typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time. Consequently, students are randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. Some take in the morning, some take them in the afternoon. That seems like a fairly benign thing. Like as a parent, as a citizen, I would look at that and say, okay, that's cool. But it's not cool because students who take the test in the afternoon score considerably lower. Students who take the test in the afternoon score as if they missed 2 weeks of school. That's a big deal. So time of day has a big effect. Just time of day alone has a big effect on our performance.
Our conversation with Dan really helped me to look at my day and to examine my peak, trough, and recovery, and to reschedule my day so I'm not wasting the best hours of my cognitive ability responding to email. Another tidbit from that interview that I'm trying to put into practice is...
pay very careful attention to ending. And there's some teachers I write about in the book who do some really extraordinary things on endings, where at the end of the semester or the end of a year, there's one high school teacher in Illinois who has a senior's write letters to themselves that he mails to them 5 years later, which is pretty remarkable. There are other teachers who bring in, have a massive pancake breakfast on the final day of school. There's a college teacher. I love this one. The college teacher who on the final day takes her students out and they make to a bar, not something you want to do for under 21, but take students out to a bar and they make toasts to each other and talk about what they learned. But you can imagine that. Imagine that in like a second or third grade classroom.
Yeah.
Where students make toasts to each other about what they like about the other person or what they learned during the year from that other person. That's just gorgeous. Endings have a big, big effect on our behavior, on our well-being. And there's some really astonishing teachers out there who are doing extraordinary things on endings.
And we all have an amazing new start coming with kids, and they get back from break in the next week, and we can use that to start to pave the new way into an amazing end of the year.
Yeah, Becky, learning about my peak, trough, and recovery was something completely new to me. I did not know that when mattered at all, and so I loved that episode with Dan Pink. But I recently also learned that there is no bad time to formatively assess your students. And so episode 14 with Dr. Ducour and Dr. Holmberg, who wrote the book on formative assessment moves, was awesome and blew my mind several times when it came to formative assessment. But I especially loved it when they talked about...
Here it is, number 4.
We all know that there's a tremendous demand on pacing and moving through our material and making sure we cover every single thing. So there is that sense of the demands of getting through the material make you want to suspect that the students don't really know much and that's why they're there. Well, I've come to since realize there's a deep psychology and a lot of research around how people learn. The National Research Council wrote a book in 1999, just a couple of years before it put out the work on knowing what students know. And in that book, it stated very clearly, kids actually do need to build on prior knowledge and associations, not just of facts, but sometimes of misperceptions or even just random ideas that they may have picked up from TV. They may have picked up from hearing a conversation at the dinner table that they may have gotten from a previous class years ago. And so from some reason, it's stuck in their memory. You know, most kids come to our classrooms with a lot of prior cultural knowledge. So every teacher wants to make use of that material as a check for where the kids are on a concept. Kids are better served when we build the bridges from where their own understanding is to the content than when we sort of ignore it and pretend that they're a blank slate. You know, part of the sensibility of this book and of, I would say, really the education research for the last 20 years has been around what we call, again, constructivism. Some people call it sociocultural learning. But at the end of the day, these are big words to just say, hey, figure out what the kids know in part by unpacking their experience. If it worked for John Dewey, I think it'll work for us too.
Really, the entire interview changed how I think about assessment for learning. And I think I've done a much better job honoring the background experience of the participants in learning that I've led. So it was just such a beneficial interview and such a great book.
Nice. Did you like how in my last one, I snuck like three top favorite moments in there instead of just one?
Yeah, I noticed
that. I'm cheating a little bit. I know, but it's fine. So those two, I'm glad you brought them up. They were so fun to talk to. And honoring what kids bring to the table through formative assessment is super important, which actually brings me to my number four spot. I love how these are flowing so well into each other, which really, I think, just speaks to the consistency of message that we've found among our guests. But in any case, I loved our conversation with the queen bee of EdTech, Jenny Magiera. In episode 10, she had a lot of moments that really stuck with me, but especially when she said this.
I mean, there's the obvious relationship building of talk to them, right? You know, have lunch with them, you know, things like that, that in my first couple of years of teaching, you know, you want to survive. And I didn't eat lunch for years, you know, and no one does, you know. I was at one of those schools where you had 20 minutes after you dropped off your kids to like go to the bathroom, make two calls to a parent, and then it's like lunch is over, pick up your class. But I started doing something that I was inspired by some of my colleagues doing, which is like, I'm going to eat lunch every day, but I'm going to do it not by sitting in the teacher's lounge, but by like sitting with my kids. And it's a time for me to talk to them and not about like, did you do your homework or like stop, you know, bothering Jaheim every day, la, la, la. But like, just let's chat. Like, oh, you're into Avatar. Cool. Like my cousins are, let's talk. I would eat lunch at a different table every day and sit with different kids. And it became like my favorite part of the day because I could just be me and just talk to my kids and get to know them. Something else too is especially if you work in a high needs area. So I've always served in what folks call like underserved or low income, high risk schools. And I think that we fall, especially if we were lucky enough to be raised in a more privileged community and an upbringing, to feel like when you serve in those communities that you're trying to save the students. Like I'm here to bring them opportunities and I need to save them and I need to like help them see the doorways they can walk through. And I think that there's a level of arrogance and hubris in that thinking. And so to be really careful about seeing our kids as whole people and not as you know, units that you need to shove knowledge into, or underserved students you need to save, or a kid with an IEP that I need to like get to the next level, but like as human beings. Oh. And I think that shift in thinking is really nuanced and minute. But if you really think about it, like, how are you thinking about these kids? Are you thinking about them like you think of your own siblings or cousins or children? It really changes the way you talk to them. But it also changes the types of questions you ask them. So I really tried to make sure that I was never coming into conversations with my kids as a savior, or as, you know, someone better, or as the teacher who is like in this very defined role, but just as one human being talking to another. And it, because of that, I got to ask deeper questions and say like, wow, you're really interested in this. Like, why is that so cool to you? Or, you know, what are you doing this weekend? And not just to make small talk, but because I really want to know.
We are teaching the future doctors, future engineers, future lawyers, but they matter now. And that was just loud and clear from Jenny. And I really enjoyed hearing her say that. And it rocked my world. So kids matter now, but moments also matter. And I think an episode that had the biggest impact on me as a parent and probably an educator too came from Dan Heath, who taught us how to make moments and make moments that matter even more. So my three spot in the 2018 list goes to episode 23 when Dan Heath talks about...
Beware the soul-sucking force of reasonableness. You know, that peak moments are rarely reasonable. If you think about the peak moments from your life, probably none of them fit the description reasonable. Wedding days, there is nothing reasonable about a wedding day. You know, to spend $700 on a dress you'll never wear again, and thousands of dollars on flowers and music that will only last a night. And yet, in every part of the globe, even in the poorest places on earth, people spend or save rather for months or for years to make this a great day. So all I'm really saying is these instincts that we seem to have in different parts of life, like our instinct to make a wedding day great or a graduation day great, those same instincts should also apply to the lessons we teach in school. I'll give you an example from outside education I think makes the point, and that is it starts at a hotel actually in LA called the Magic Castle Hotel. And if you've never stayed at the Magic Castle, it's not a very big place. Just kind of picture in your mind's eye what the Magic Castle might look like. And then let me reveal, it looks nothing like that picture in your head. What it looks like is a two-story apartment complex built in the 1950s. It was later converted over to use as really more of a motel than a hotel. It was painted bright yellow. There's a pool in the courtyard that's about the size of like a suburban backyard's pool. It's a very, very average looking place. The lobby, it looks like the lobby of like an oil change place, and the views aren't very good. And so why am I telling you about this very mediocre place? The reason is that this is considered the number two hotel in LA on the website TripAdvisor, based on the strength of thousands of reviews. I mean, this place I'm talking about outranks the Ritz-Carlton. It outranks the Four Seasons. And you would have to really Google the images of this place to fully appreciate the absurdity of this. The idea that this place could trump the Ritz-Carlton. And the secret is that what the Magic Castle has figured out is just how powerful these small moments can be for guests. So to make that tangible, by the pool I talked about, this you know, normal, boring looking pool, there's a cherry red phone mounted on the wall. And just above it is a sign that says Popsicle Hotline. And if you pick up the red phone, you hold it to your ear, somebody says, Popsicle Hotline will be right out. And somebody comes out minutes later wearing a suit, holding a silver tray loaded up with grape and cherry and orange popsicles. They bring them out to you poolside, wearing white gloves like an English butler, all for free. Mm. They have a snack menu where you can get like Cracker Jacks and root beer and Sour Patch Kids and whatever your heart desires just by going up to the front desk and asking. And they have board game menus where you can check out games to play with your families. They'll do your laundry if you drop it off in the morning. They'll have it washed and folded, returned to you by the end of the day. They have magicians doing tricks in the lobby a couple times a week. And so when I paint that picture, you can understand how a family might just straight up choose the Magic Castle over the Ritz-Carlton because it's more fun. You know, it's more memorable. And back to your question, you know, our instinct in life is that we can improve things by fixing the problems with them. And so you imagine a hotel owner who just inherited this property, the Magic Castle Hotel, you know, picture the two-story apartment complex. But imagine that the person who took it over had not yet put into place the moments I was telling you about, the Popsicle Hotline and otherwise. Imagine that their philosophy had been, I'm going to take a survey of every guest who stays here, and by God, whatever they complain about, I'm going to fix it. So if their pillows were too firm, I'm going to get some soft pillows. And if their lamps were too bright and they didn't like it, I'm going to get some dimmer bulbs. And if they're checking too long and annoyed them, I'm going to hire more people to work the front desk. And if we ask ourselves, will that hotel get better over time? There's no question. You're fixing problems. It will get better. But if you ask, could that hotel have ever become the number two hotel in Los Angeles? The answer is obviously not. No chance, right? You can never problem solve your way to a really happy, memorable experience. And that's the point about potholes, is that we distract ourselves so much by fixing potholes that we never get around to building peaks. And I think if you think about your school through that lens, you'll know exactly what I'm getting at, that we spend so much energy trying to make schools run, you know, trying to make the trains run on time, trying to make them, you know, more efficient. And meanwhile, we've lost the opportunity to construct from scratch the kinds of moments that if we had built them, would have made people forgive 1,000 other tiny problems.
Go make some moments, people.
That's awesome. I'm hungry for a popsicle just remembering that interview. But that's totally right. And crafting those peak moments and breaking away from the status quo is a huge risk sometimes. So that brings me to my number three spot of the year, back in episode 21, when Catelyn Tucker says,
our classroom spaces should be a place where everybody is experimenting, everybody is taking risks, and everybody is learning. That can't just be the students. The students have to see the teachers doing all of those things too. Engage your students in a conversation about, okay, this is what we're trying and this is why we're trying it. And I have no idea how this is going to go, but let's give it a whirl and let's experiment and we might fail and hey, that's okay. And I worry that teachers think like, I have to get this all figured out. I have to master it. I have to have everything in place before I can do my test run. And that's where the time and the fear comes in. Because if we feel we must be perfect, we must master something before we ever try it in the classroom, we're not going to try very much. We're not going to be super innovative. We're not going to be able to kind of iterate and adjust as quickly as we would if we were willing to use that classroom, almost like a laboratory.
And this idea that we should model the type of learner that we want our students to be, we should be the type of leader that we want to have, that we should all be risking learning and reflecting constantly in the classroom, I just think is something that we can all carry with us every day.
Yeah, I agree with you, Becky, but not because I actually agree, but because I'm a powerless people pleaser. Just kidding. No, I really do agree with you about Catelyn. But as to the powerless people pleasing, I would say I'm now a recovering people pleaser because of our conversation with Kim Scott, author of Radical Candor, all the way back in episode 4, where she told the story about...
Radical candor is the ability to challenge someone directly in a way that shows them that you care personally about them. And really what radical candor is about is how to collaborate effectively with a group of people, no matter what your goal is. The mistake that most of us make, more than any other mistake, is what I call ruinous empathy. And that's where we do so care about the other person and the other person's feelings that we fail to tell them something that they really need to know. Probably the low point of my whole career. Bob was not this person's real name, but let's call him Bob. So I had hired Bob, and I really liked Bob. He was smart. He was charming. He was funny. He would do stuff like one time we were at an offsite, and we were playing one of those endless get-to-know-you games, and we were all busy, and we all wanted to get home to our families. But nobody dared say it. Finally, Bob was the guy who was brave enough to raise his hand and say, I've got a great idea, and it'll be really fast. And so whatever it was, we were willing to do it. So Bob said, let's just go around the table and confess what candy our parents used when potty training us. weird, but fast. We were all willing to do it. And then for the next 10 months, every time there was a tense moment in a meeting, Bob would whip out just the right piece of candy for the right person at the right
time. Wow. Stop it.
Yeah, it was very funny. So we liked Bob. He was fun. He was charming. The problem, there was only one problem with Bob. He was doing terrible work. Absolutely terrible work. In fact, he would hand stuff into me and there would be shame in his eyes. He knew, I think, that his work was not nearly good enough. But because I liked Bob and I didn't want to hurt his feelings, and to be a little bit harsher on myself, it wasn't pure ruinous empathy that I didn't tell Bob his work wasn't nearly good enough. There was also a little bit of manipulative insincerity mixed in because, you know, Bob was popular on the team. Everybody liked Bob. I was worried if I told Bob his work wasn't nearly good enough, it would upset him and he would start to cry or something. And then everybody would think I was a total jerk.
Right.
And I didn't want that reputation. And so partly because I cared about Bob, but also partly because I wanted to be liked, I didn't tell Bob. By the way, the desire to be liked is the path to hell for a leader. But anyway, so for these two reasons, I didn't ever tell Bob that his work wasn't nearly good enough. I would just say stuff like, oh, Bob, you're so smart. We love working with you. This is a great start. Maybe you can make it a little better. And of course, he never did. And because he never did, the burden of fixing his work fell on the rest of the team. And after about 10 months of this, the inevitable happened. And I realized that if I didn't fire Bob, I was going to lose half my team. Mm-hmm. And so I sat down to have the conversation with Bob that I should have started 10 months previously. And when I was finished explaining to him how things stood, he sort of pushed his chair back from the table. He looked me right in the eye and he said, why didn't you tell me? Oof. Yeah.
And just a punch in the gut.
Yeah. yeah. And as that question is going around in my head with no good answer, he looks at me again and he says, "Why didn't anyone tell me? I thought you all cared about me."
And while I constantly need to remind myself of this, what I learned from Kim is that feedback is one of the biggest gifts that we can give to our students, our colleagues, and our friends. And so I want to keep working harder to give meaningful feedback, even if it makes me feel a little bit scratchy.
And that's an area that I think I've gotten a little bit better in because of our conversation with Kim and because of reading her book and talking about it with others. The feedback we give to each other is so important. And that's why for my number two spot, I'm going to yield the floor to our amazing Dr. Tony Wagner, or Tony as he likes to be called, who started us very strong in our first episode when he said,
"Our profession is afflicted with the curse of isolation. We are arguably the most isolated profession in modern work life. We work alone all day, every day. And yet the talent challenges that I've described are challenges that we cannot try to solve by ourselves. It's simply, it's too difficult. Isolation is the enemy of improvement. It is the enemy of innovation. It is the enemy of science. So if we talk about teachers, scientists, scientists don't work alone. They always work in collaboration. Innovation and improvement are driven by, I think, reciprocal relational accountability, teamwork."
And one of the biggest whys for this podcast is to get rid of the isolation that plagues public ed and to help us all be more connected educators. One of the things that our listeners may not know is that any teacher in the state of Colorado can get professional development credits just for listening to our show and reflecting on what they learned. And in those reflections, we've heard over and over and over that this sentiment by Tony Wagner was really pushing people out of their classrooms into each other's practice, either in person or virtually through video. And I read over and over that people were inviting more feedback into their practice after such visits. And if there's nothing else that this podcast does, I would sincerely hope that it breaks down those barriers of isolation and helps us all collaborate more for the greater good of improving every facet of public ed.
Oh my, Becky, we did it. We counted down from five.
Woohoo!
Here we are, our number one favorite spot. Becky, your drum roll.
My favorite all-time moment from this incredible journey has to come from the episode with the king of visible learning, John Hattie, when he encouraged us to know thy impact. Those three little words are tattooed on my brain.
Know thy impact.
I wish I could do it in an Australian accent, but I'm just not going to put you guys through that. But when he said that 95 to 97% of what we do in the classroom works, but that we have to ask ourselves to what degree, then put our energy where we can have the most impact, I think that's why sometimes classroom teachers feel so burnt out, because we're spinning our wheels on activities that maybe don't have a large effect size on learning.
This is a strong statement, probably too strong, but I couldn't care less how teachers teach. And too much professional learning is about how you teach. It's about sharing resources. It's about understanding curriculum. Oh my gosh, it's about best practice. I don't care how they teach. I care about the impact of their teaching. And that's a dramatically different orientation.
So I'd highly encourage listeners to dig into the visible learning framework and learn more about the high impact moves, especially collective efficacy, which, you know, we kind of just talked about too with getting into each other's classrooms. But a great deal of impact comes from our belief in our own ability to create change with the people around us. So ask yourself, do you feel like you have the agency to create change in your environment? And if not, why not? And then let's take that further into conversations with each other, with our colleagues, with our administrators. And if we all challenge each other to know our impact and have open discussions about that impact, we can really move mountains.
Okay, Dad, your turn. What you got for number one?
And now, the moment that's been building for an entire year, our favorite moment from Brainwaves 2018 comes from...
You. You are awesome teachers.
You. You, the best audience in the entire world. Bar none, the best part of this entire experience has been learning from and with y'all. It's been invigorating to read tweets from teachers all over the country who try out strategies. It's been inspiring to get emails and Facebook messages from schools all over where teachers have taken the advice of our giants in education and put it into practice. From schools working to build in more peak moments to a whole grade level team sending postcards home to kids over the break. It's just been amazing to see the impact that our loyal listeners are having. And even just like a cool story that I just heard yesterday was one of our listeners dedicated herself after episode 4 to every time she listened to Brainwaves, she was going to be moving. And now 23 episodes later, she's lost 10 pounds and had an awesome impact on kids. So it has just been an amazing 2018, and bringing giants to the earbuds of you has been the best part.
And as we gear up for an even better 2019, just wait until you see what we have in store. It's going to be amazing. We want to issue a challenge to you. So based on the advice from Giants in Education, what are your goals for the new year? What did you learn or have reinforced that you want to put into practice next semester? We remember back to the most recent episode when Stephen Shedletsky shared that you're much more successful in your endeavors when you write down your goal, and even more so when you share it. So we want you to not only write it down, but also to share it with our community using the hashtag #MakeSomeBrainwaves. And we will all keep each other accountable for these goals. Thank you so much for a completely unforgettable 2018, and we will catch you next year.